welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we are back into content. Now, this is the bread and butter of the show, folks. I told you... In an upcoming, either it'll probably do on, I'll do it on a Monday, but in an upcoming Monday, sorry, my tongue is a little frozen, and it's not from eating something cold. But anyway, on an upcoming Monday, I'm going to kind of go through some of the, you know, why does GR, you know, why did I play that music? You know, why Reclaiming the Republic? Why Republic Review? Some of those types of things, you know, so you can see the, like, if you care to understand, because there's a reason for everything. I'm a person that believes in making sure that, you know, there, you know, I'm using something that actually has some real meaning behind it, like the music. Why do I use that very specific piece? Anyway, and I do this just because I know that our audience is growing. And so I want people to kind of have those insights. That way, you know, eventually there'll be, you know, some questions on trivia tests, you know, in a trivia pursuit type of question, pursuits. That, does that make sense, Paul?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. And so we got Paul back with us, Paul Venable, and he's the chair of the Constitution Party for Missouri. And are you planning on running for office this coming 2024?
I am floating running for office. It looks like I'm going to
take out Josh Hawley. Are you going to take Josh Hawley out finally? finally get rid of that Josh, guy?
You know, I'll tell you what. Josh Hawley is a really popular guy in Missouri, but he doesn't address any constitutional issues.
No, as a matter of fact, he steps on it and... Anyway, I'm not impressed with anything he's said or does. It's never in context of the Constitution. But, right. You know, who is in context? Not even Rand Paul is. So
there really is no one in Congress who is in the context of the Constitution. I picked up a book. Actually, I got a book from Ron Paul several years ago called A Foreign Policy of Freedom. And I'm going through this thing, and he is just lambasting the Congress using the Constitution. And I don't know that anyone has done that since. I just don't.
Not enough. Not enough people are doing that. I mean, it's just, it gets tiring to say the same things over and over again. And believe it or not, it gets tiring of being right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. All I know is that it's so important to at least lay this out so that there's a record, so that, you know, maybe somebody somewhere, either after we're under the heel of tyranny completely, once we've lost the Constitution and everything else, and, you know, those of us have, you know, died, maybe somebody will uncover this stuff and go, hey, this guy was right. This is what should have happened.
Right.
Right. At some point, you know, at some point it'll come up. Anyway. Anywho, right. So we're in the last state that ratified, that actually contested the Constitution, or there was at least a good, arduous, you know, battle between the anti-federalists and the federalists, and this is North Carolina. Now, let me ask you this. Would you consider Rhode Island, would you consider them anti-federalists or... What?
You know, I wasn't sure that they were anti-federalists or just contrarian.
Yes.
Because we had so much trouble with Rhode Island that it was hard to tell. Sometimes they were just unresponsive, and
yes.
you know, they just they were the rogues, okay?
Yes.
And so I don't know exactly know how to answer that question, except that we're just contrary.
Right. I mean, you know, everybody knows that, you know, or everybody at least has one thorn in their side person, right? And
Right.
so the United States had Rhode Island, and that was a thorn
Right.
in our side. And, you know, you could say side because it's right there on the coast. It's this little swath of land right there. And I don't know. Anyway, you know, they, you're right. The contrarians, they were completely, well, they weren't just contrarians. They were up to real shenanigans. I mean, fiat money,
You're right.
I can tell you that when you start printing out money, you're not just hurting, you know, people outside your state. You're hurting people in the state too.
Let me ask you another question,
Sure.
because a lot of people don't know that the full name of Rhode Island was Rhode Island and Providence Plantations.
Yes.
And I that leads to a question is whether or not Rhode Island may have been a slave state, you know,
Sure.
with the term plantation in it.
Sure.
And so,
Yes.
really,
Yes.
okay.
Yes, it
And
was.
so as an Eastern state, that kind of surprised me, because
Why? Wait, so
until I knew that,
you
you
got to
know.
remember, so when was Rhode Island, the colony, established?
Well, I don't remember, but
So
we can certainly look it
it
up.
was a small colony, a very small colony, and it was established in the 1600s, and the first state to actually not form, but to actually, you know, create, you know, some changes, you know, as far as a shift in the paradigm, was Maryland with the Tolerance Act of, I forget, 16 something, where they became tolerant towards other religions. In other words, it was the first state that actually had was open to and allowing other religions to practice. However, the state had aligned with, and I'd have to look it up, I'm pretty sure it was the Anglican Church, because you could probably swing a bat and hit three-fourths of the states were Anglican Church. There were a few others that were either congressional or there was the Puritans, right? So anyway, so Rhode Island was, you know, one of those early, well, obviously it was a colony, but it was a part of, you know, growing. And I don't know what they grew because they are kind of northern latitude, but all of the states at that point in time had slaves. Even the northern states, except for, I think there was
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, Vermont, those very ultra northern states. I think Connecticut was a non-slave state. I think New York, actually, when it was New Amsterdam, was a non-slave state. I don't know if you knew that when
I
because
didn't.
the Danish, you know, the people that settled that were from, you know, Denmark or Holland, I should say,
Holland, right.
and so they came in and they established a colony, and they did not believe in slavery. So what ended up happening is a lot of English colonists migrated into New York and they voted to make it a colony of England. In other words, this invasion concept of invaders coming across borders. I just want you to understand this.
It's not
When
new.
the framers use the context of an invasion, they don't think of just a military force. It could be a mass migration because they saw it in their own history, where they took a state away from another nation and, you know, made it pulled it underneath the crown of Britain.
You know what? That is a great example of what we're dealing with.
Right. And that's exactly what the globalists are doing because they know if they water down the American culture, and they've got to do this to get everybody to just, you know, okay, you know, all right, we're not American anymore. What are we now? Oh, we're the part of the global community. We're part of the global family.
Citizen of the world,
There you
right?
go. That's what Obama used to use. Yep. So anyway, we've kind of wrapped up with paper money and the Bill of Rights, which was basically what Mr. Davey had basically articulated. And now Mr. Locke is contributing, and this is the same spelling, folks, as John Locke. Now, he could be a descendant, right?
Okay.
I don't know. I've never looked the details up. But anyway, so let's go ahead and start off with such reasoning would probably be a good place.
There we go. All right. Such reasoning is very strange to me. I fear greatly for the state and for other states. I find there has a considerable stress been laid upon the injustice of laws made heretofore. Great reflections are thrown on South Carolina for passing Pine Barren and installment laws, and on this state for making paper money. Okay, so he's referring to on this state. So North Carolina had been making paper money, but what are Pine Barren and installment, or do you know?
So those are jargons for types of laws that they passed. I've never looked it up.
Okay.
We can look it up, but
that's fine.
Right. But when he's basically saying great reflections are thrown on South Carolina and on this state for making paper money.
Okay.
So in other words, the rest of the Union does not look with favor with how they applied their paper money.
Okay.
Okay.
I wish those gentlemen who made those observations would consider the necessity which compelled us in a great measure to make such money. I never thought the law which authorized it a good law. If the evil could have been avoided, it would have been a very bad law. But necessity, sir, justified it in some degree. Is this guy a Federalist or an Anti-Federalist? I'm just asking.
You know, I don't know. He's making a point, though, that they felt their back was to the wall, and, you know, we ended up doing this. It's an admission, right?
Okay. I believe I have gained as little by it as any in this house. If we are to judge of the future by what we have seen, we shall find as much or more injustice in Congress than in our legislature. Necessity compelled them to pass the law in order to save vast numbers of people from ruin. I hope to be excused in observing that it would have been hard for our late Continental Army to lay down their arms with which they had valiantly and successfully fought for their country without receiving or being promised and assured of some compensation for their past services. What a situation would this country have been in if they had had the power over the purse and sword? If they had had the powers given up by this Constitution, what a wretched situation would this country have been in? Congress was unable to pay them, but passed many resolutions and laws in their favor, particularly one that each state should make up the depreciation of the pay of the Continental Line, who were distressed for the want of an adequate compensation for their services. This state could not pay her proportion in specie. To have laid a tax for that purpose would have been oppressive. What was to be done? The only expedient was to pass a law to make paper money and make it tender. The Continental Line was satisfied and approved of the measure, it being done at their instance in some degree. Notwithstanding it was supposed to be highly beneficial to the state, it is found to be injurious to it. Saving expense is a very great object, but this incurred much expense. This subject has for many years embroiled the state, but the situation of the country and the distress of the people are so great that the public measures must be accommodated to their circumstances with peculiar delicacy and caution, or another insurrection may be the consequence. As to what the gentleman said of the trial by jury, it surprises me much to hear gentlemen of such great abilities speak such language. It is clearly insecure, nor can ingenuity and subtle arguments prove the contrary. I trust this country is too sensible of the value of liberty, and her citizens have bought it too dearly to give it up hastily.
So you do realize that the Shea Rebellion was, you know, over the inability to pay their taxes and the fact that they weren't compensated. And I'm not sure if you knew that in the new government, or I'm pretty sure Washington was the president of the United States when there was a move of the former Continental Army to basically march upon the this new federal government to ask for their compensation. I'm not sure if you knew that. In other words, there were many men that were never fairly compensated for what they did. They were promised the world, they were promised a certain sum, and they didn't even see half that.
Right. Right. Now, Shays Rebellion is not the Whiskey Rebellion.
So that actually was one of the catalysts that drove these states to form the Constitutional Convention to basically deal with the inadequacies of Congress, or I should say the Articles of Confederation and that form of government.
Right.
Which basically the outcome was creating a new and improved government, and it truly was a new and improved government.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
All right. So, right. And there's merit in looking it up. I remember reading the story that all of these men basically descended upon the federal government, and they were kind of all quartered, or they kind of were in this big building, and Washington went in, who, you know, at that point in time was the commander-in-chief. I'm pretty sure he was the president at this point. It's been so long since I've heard this story. But basically, all of these men had respect for him, but they were, you know, they were basically saying, hey, where is our compensation? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he went in and basically subdued the situation.
Washington did.
Washington did, yes.
He's probably the only man that could have.
Yeah, that is right. You're absolutely correct. So, in other words, Washington saved the nation once again. And there's a lot to be said with having that kind of leader in doing, you know, what was necessary to, you know, move the nation in the direction. Because, you know, we weren't an advanced nation. We weren't a nation advanced with sciences and those types of things. But we were very civil. And we were, right. You know, based on very limited law and limited government. So anyway,
so what you're saying is, Shays Rebellion is one of the things that prompted an understanding of the need for a new government.
The Shays Rebellion made it so that Washington, right after the Shays Rebellion, General Knox sent a letter to George Washington saying, the nation needs you. You need to be involved in this. Don't worry about the Order of Cincinnati. The nation needs you more than the Order of Cincinnati.
Okay.
Because he was supposed to become the president of that aristocracy.
Okay, right.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So now it's Mr. Iredell who then gets up and responds. And, you know, I would say that Mr. Locke was probably an anti-federalist. But, I mean, everything he was saying was, you know, more of just kind of defending North Carolina and not necessarily attacking the Constitution.
Okay. No, he was defending North Carolina's position.
Right.
Okay, and understood.
Right.
All right, so we are now with is this jurisdiction, Mr. Iredell?
Yep, that's where we're starting off now. Yep.
All right. We've been told, and I believe this was the real reason, why they could not concur in any general rule. I have great respect for the characters of those gentlemen who formed the convention, and I believe they were not capable.
Capable.
I believe they were not capable of overlooking the importance of the trial by jury. much less of designedly plotting against it. But I fully believe that the real difficulty of the thing was the cause of the omission. I trust sufficient reasons have been offered to show that it is in no danger. As to criminal cases, I must observe that the great instrument of arbitrary power is criminal prosecutions. By the privileges of the habeas corpus, no man can be confined without inquiry. And if it should appear that he has been committed contrary to law, he must be discharged. That diversity which is to be found in civil controversies does not exist in criminal cases. That diversity which contributes to the security of property in civil cases would have pernicious effects in criminal ones. There's no other safe mode to try these but by a jury. If any man had the means of trying another his own way, or were it left to the control of arbitrary judges, no man would have that security for life and liberty, which every freeman ought to have.
You know, so, this goes kind of, go ahead. I don't know, while you're reading this, if you're thinking about how they have administered justice to what they call the insurrectionists of January 6th.
Right. I've thought about it a lot.
Okay. And
we haven't. It's not justice.
It isn't justice, nor is it under their authority.
Mm-hmm.
So bottom line, Congress was the one that caused the injustice by shutting the people out of their house.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we read here, and as you understand in the Constitution, just because you have pictures of that's the guy, did a grand jury indict these people before they were arrested?
No.
No. As a matter of fact, they went and gathered them up, and then they put them in jail. In other words, they suspended their writ of habeas corpus because you couldn't even write that without an indictment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's what it says. The Fifth Amendment, I believe, clearly states that only after an indictment of the grand jury can you actually take and go seize a man, but he still has this right of due process and a speedy trial.
GR, I think they've got a dragnet going on. I think they're still picking people up for this.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
I wasn't there, so they, there's no way they could, come pick me up for that. They could pick me up for other things, but the point is that this is arbitrary power. This is tyranny. That is the epitome of what tyranny is when government uses arbitrary power.
Okay. So, quick question. I know in what I just read about paper money, this guy actually, Mr. Locke, actually transitioned in his last line to trial by jury. And they're discussing that here. And I'm trying to remember, I know that the right to trial by jury is brought up in the Bill of Rights. Okay?
Yeah, it is. But so more importantly, it was Thomas Jefferson that pointed out that the only jurisdiction the federal government has over, mm-hmm. Any crimes whatsoever is counterfeiting, piracy on the high seas, or crimes committed against the laws of nations, and or mm-hmm. treason. And so, they don't have the ability to just create any criminal law.
Right.
That was it. The states, the only time they were actually able to create a new criminal law and enforce it via the militia was when you actually had the prohibition law go into effect.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
And the states would have criminal law, but the only laws that,
okay.
that are
so Paul, I hate to say this, Paul, but we actually just came up against a hard break, and once again, I wasn't looking at the clock, so forgive me. And so we'll be right back, and I'll let you finish your comment, and then we can move ahead. But folks, we'll be right back after this one promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I obviously didn't see that coming. I apologize, Paul. So anyway, you were just about to say something. I hope you remember what you were saying. Paul, are you there?
Well, of course I'm here, but I mute during the break. Sorry.
That's okay. That happened. So that's okay.
Yeah. So here's what was my question is, I was wondering what was concerning, you know, trial by jury is in Article 3, Section 2. Okay. So I didn't understand why they were, what their concern was, okay? I didn't understand why they were making something of it. It says the trial of all crimes, it says, except in case of impeachment, shall be by jury.
So
what were they concerned about?
So let's move forward, because I think Mr. Iredell, because he starts off talking about, you know, he believed that those people who went into the convention did everything they could.
Right.
So let's go ahead and finish this part regarding jurisdiction and
right.
See what he says. It may answer your question.
All right.
All right.
I presume that in no state on the continent is a man tried on a criminal accusation but by a jury. It was necessary, therefore, that it should be fixed in the Constitution that the trial should be by jury in criminal cases, and such difficulties did not occur in this as in the other case. The worthy gentleman says that by not being provided for in civil cases, it is expressly provided against, and that what is not expressed is given up. Were it so, no man would be more against this Constitution than myself. I should detest and oppose it as much as any man, but, sir, this cannot be the case. I beg leave to say that that construction appears to me absurd and unnatural, as it could not be fixed either on the principles of uniformity or diversity. It must be left to Congress to modify it. If they establish it in any manner by law and find it inconvenient, they can alter it. But I am convinced that a majority of the representatives of the people will never attempt to establish a mode oppressive to their constituents, as it will be their own interest to take care of this right. But it is observed that there ought to be a fence provided against future encroachments of power. If there be not such a fence, it is a cause of objection. I readily agree that there ought to be such a fence. The instrument ought to contain such a definition of authority as would leave no doubt, and if there be any ambiguity, it ought not to be admitted. He says this construction is not agreeable to the people, though he acknowledges it is a right one. In my opinion, there is no man of any reason at all, but must be satisfied with so clear and plain a definition. If the Congress should claim any power not given them, it would be as bare usurpation as making a king in America. If this Constitution be adopted, it must be presumed the instrument will be in the hands of every man in America to see whether authority be usurped, and any person by inspecting it may see if the power claimed be enumerated. If it be not, he will know it to be a usurpation. Wow.
Did he answer your question?
I think so. here's the other thing that I really like about this last line, mm-hmm. is that he presumed that the Constitution would be in the hands of every man in America.
Right.
And that they would understand when it's being violated.
By inspecting it, may see the power of claimed be enumerated. If right. it be not, he will know it to be an usurpation.
Yeah, that's like a wow.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So now, I'm really pushing the color-coded Constitution. Okay. And it's not like this is something we're making money on. I'm not selling this. But I think it's that important that when people are reading the document, they know what parts that they're reading that are actually being, you know, egregiously violated.
Right.
So, anyway, now the next person to speak is going to be Mr. McClain, and he's going to pick up on the comment regarding the paper money. Here's a novel concept, and here's a something that, you know, I would pose for the people to ponder on. If you look at those like Mr. Iredell and Hamilton and so forth, these men were lawyers who were ardent defenders of the law, who ensured that justice was being served. Today, lawyers are actually, you know, they're like blacksmith. They're trying to bend the metal. They're trying to twist it so that they can obtain some form of, you know, self-aggrandizement, you know, money, what have you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems that way, doesn't it?
Right. It seems like the legal, well, you know, in Christ's day, he alluded to the fact that moral turpitude had predominated or was, you know, prevailing in the legal industry because, you know, whenever he talked of a lawyer, I mean, he didn't have the most favorable things to say.
Right.
Right. And so I guess, you know, for 2,000 years, this has been a prevailing problem. That people get into the law as a way to try to, you know, twist the law, to, you know, to bend the law and become good at doing that. And that's, anyway, it kind of infuriating, but it's the nature. So now Mr. McClain is going to talk about the paper money. He's going to address the paper money argument because Iredell got up and kind of handled the legal side of this. Now paper money.
All right, so Mr. McClain, paper money. Mr. Chairman, a gentleman lately up, Mr. Locke, has informed us of his doubts and fears respecting the federal courts. He is afraid for this state and other states. He supposes that the idea of cognizance of the laws of the Union to federal courts must have arisen from suspicions of partiality and want of common integrity in our state judges. The worthy gentleman is mistaken in his construction of what I said. I did not personally reflect on the members of our state judiciary, nor did I impute the impropriety of vesting the state of the state judiciaries with exclusive jurisdiction over the laws of the Union and cases arising under the Constitution to any want of probity in the judges. But if they be the judges of the local or state laws and receive emoluments for acting in that capacity, they will be improper persons to judge the laws of the Union. A federal judge ought to be solely governed by the laws of the United States and receive his salary from the Treasury of the United States.
So let me, do you notice what he just said?
Okay.
He who pays the piper calls the tune.
Correct.
And so it would be improper if the state was paying that judge for that judge to have any basically hear any cases regarding federal issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do we say about the federal courts hearing issues like that aren't under their jurisdiction, like abortion, like health care, like, you know, the vaccine mandates, all of these different things that, you know, the courts are hearing, the federal courts hear everything.
But the federal courts shouldn't be hearing anything that's outside the jurisdiction.
And to that point, they get paid to actually, you know, cross that line. And they get paid to do everything they can to cross that line. That's how it's gotten today.
That's so, but they're not on a federal and state payroll. They're only on a federal payroll.
They're on
right?
a federal payroll. Correct. But they are doing things that actually reaches out and has an adverse effect on the states. You know, like with Reynolds v. Sims and Baker v. Carr, when they basically said, you states can't have this form of government. You have to change based on population and move you more towards a democracy.
Right.
Right.
I'm highlighting this one particularly because... Thank you. That is valuable. Okay. Where did I leave off? They clash with the laws of the union.
So go ahead and start off again with, it is impossible for any judges receiving pay.
There it is. It is impossible for any judges receiving pay from a single state to be impartial in cases where the local laws or interests of that state clash with the laws of the union or the general interests of America. We have interests here which prove this partiality in such cases. It is also so in other states. The gentleman has thrown out something very uncommon. He likens the power given by this Constitution to giving the late army the purse and the sword. I'm much astonished that such an idea should be thrown out by that gentleman because his respectability is well known. If he considers for a moment, he must see that his observation is bad and that the comparison is extremely absurd and improper. The purse and the sword must be given to every government. The sword is given to the executive magistrate, but the purse remains by this Constitution in the representatives of the people. We know very well that they can raise one shilling, but by the consent of the representatives of the people. Money bills do not originate in the Senate. They originate solely in the other house. Every appropriation must be by law.
Oh, let me, you know, I'm going to beg leave and interrupt you.
Okay.
So one of the things he points out, I'm going to jump up. The sword is given to the executive magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, he's not the executive. So a magistrate is also a judge.
Okay.
A magistrate. So the word magistrate means that you are the grand poobah of all things.
Okay.
And in the British government, that was the king. And right. There was this, it was the doctrine of magistrate, where the king would delegate down to other executives or to sheriffs this power so that they could actually, you know, execute his laws, or they could further make laws to execute his laws and be the judge, jury, and executioner.
Okay.
That's what a magistrate is. They make the laws, they become the judge and the jury and the executioner. And so, you know, he's talking about something that I think he was incorrect. But that's a paradigm that, you know, was prevailing, and it's still prevailing today.
Okay. So,
because we clearly have separations of power.
So I'm thinking what occurred to me when I see the term magistrate was that it was such a common word, like you said, that the paradigm was prevailing and that maybe they use the term magistrate more loosely than we ought to use it today.
Oh, yes. Yes. And as a matter of fact, I can understand at this point in time, you know, the vernacular hadn't changed, but today, we should not be using the term magistrate in context to any of our government. We have such well-defined separations of power that a magistrate doesn't exist.
That's important to know.
That is.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's okay. I do too. So, let's see. Money bills do
not go ahead. Okay. So go ahead. Money appropriation must be by law.
Right.
Or money bills will not even originate. Go ahead. Yeah.
Right. Every appropriation must be by law. We know, therefore, that no executive magistrate or officer can appropriate a shilling but as he is authorized by law. With respect to paper money, the gentleman has acted and spoken with great candor. He was against paper money from the first emission. There was no other way to satisfy the late army but by paper money, there being not a shilling of specie in the state. There were other modes adopted by other states which did not produce such inconveniences. There was, however, a considerable majority of that assembly who adopted the idea that not one shilling more paper money should be made because of the evil consequences that must necessarily follow. The experience of this country for many years has proved that such emissions involve us in debts and distrusts, destroy our credit, and produce no good consequences. And yet, contrary to all good policy, the evil was repeated. And it's being repeated again today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we can blame Nixon for really propagating this because, I mean, he's the one that established this concept of getting completely away from the gold standard. Or I should say the conversion, right? Okay. Where you could take your dollar and actually get it exchanged for gold or silver.
So real quick, I don't recall whether we had this discussion in one of the broadcasts or whether you and I had it privately. And it had to, and you might remember, but it was the idea that, you know, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. But who wants to carry gold bars and silver bars around or silver coins around? So I think I asked, is it, you know, it's not that the idea of paper money is worthless paper that's not backed by anything. On the other hand, at one point we had maybe a gold or silver certificates that people could carry for convenience simply because, you know, that wasn't necessarily paper money. It was paper with backing. It was paper with value. Correct? I don't remember if we had this as a private conversation, if we had it on air, but I'm sure that, you know, this goes through people's heads, and that's why I bring it up.
Yeah, so FDR took us off the gold standard, and it was Nixon that basically took away the ability and the law that allowed us to convert paper to coin or metal. Okay. And so... clearly, they're very aware of the consequences that they talk about here. I mean, they basically show, and it's being proven today, how, mm-hmm. you know, the cost of everything has gone up. In other words, this is how they steal our wealth.
Right.
And so there's a way of getting back to that. But, you know, can a state, let me ask you this, can a state create their own gold and silver coin?
Well, I think that you're supposed to take your gold and silver coin to the mint, which isn't necessarily run by the state. But, if the state can make nothing but gold and silver coin, you know what? I think they're prohibited from aren't they prohibited from coining money?
Yes, or because Congress shall have the power to coin money.
Right.
It doesn't You're say right. that the state has that power, but it does mm-hmm. say that the state... The state shall and make anything but not gold anything. And silver coin a tender in payment of debts.
Yes. Right.
So in other words, actually it does say this. No state shall, and if you actually go ... and then coin money, emit right. bills of credit or make anything. So it says right there that they can't coin money. And, okay. you know, Wyoming and other states are going down the path of creating their own coin.
Mm.
And I'm going, well, that's interesting. You know, it seems like that's going to be, as a matter of fact, that becomes a part of the Constitution that I have to highlight because I'm looking at the color-coded Constitution, and I don't think at any point in time, other than I think maybe recently, where states were talking about creating coin, and I think that there are some states that actually have created their own coin. And if that's the case, then, bink, that gets highlighted, that one little coin right. money.
Mm-hmm. So they can use nothing but gold and silver coin for, you know, as a tender for payment of debt, but they can't be creating their own coin.
That is correct.
That's a job of Congress. Yeah. I mean, right.
But, mm-hmm.
okay. Okay.
No, you're right. It's a job of Congress, yeah. not the executive, not the judiciary. Right. It is Congress's job. They have the power to coin money. Yes.
So here's the question. And we know that, you know, we know that paper money creates this inflationary practice, which is the tax that hits you from behind your back.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Steals the value of your money. So here's the question. Maybe we'll get to this somewhere else. How do we fix this? In other words, how do we return to real money?
It would have right? to. So it would have to be a transition. There's no. You can't just turn off.
Snap
you know
your fingers,
your paper
right.
is now worthless. There has right. to be a plan that the states actually have to move in that direction. And one of the things that actually has to happen is that all of our gold mines and silver mines need to be opened up. And we need to start digging again.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lots of gold mines. Guess where?
In lands that are being held by the federal government.
That is right. Because Bill Clinton made some changes regarding some national forests and land and released certain forests so that he could actually create federal reserves over the mines that it's basically to shut them down.
So essentially, we shut down the ability for the people to pull their wealth out of the ground that helps the nation.
Right.
All right?
Right.
It substitutes something phony
yep.
for something real. To be honest,
we would need to go back to, and it's, I honestly believe that we need to include palladium and platinum.
Okay.
As a higher valued commodity, you know, in other words, mm-hmm. your gold may be worth this much and your palladium or platinum may be worth more.
Okay.
Until we get to a point where we can actually invert that because it's all based on the availability, what is coming in. And so we need to actually convert everything. And who knows? I mean, there's got to be a way because there is a way of basically establishing the value of gold plating based on the commodity market currently, right? Mm-hmm. It's all supply and demand. And so eventually we'll be able to, you know, start elevating gold to where palladium or platinum becomes another transition between silver and gold.
Right. Ah, okay.
Right. So okay. that way, silver becomes, sorry about that. Silver becomes the bottom side next to copper underneath it mm-hmm. because we need right. to reintroduce copper again,
mm-hmm.
where a dollar is equivalent to whatever, 10 ounces of copper, whatever that is.
Right.
Because right now, what is an ounce of copper worth?
I don't know. I could actually look it up for you.
Right. Well, it's worth more than a penny. I mean, the penny itself, the penny itself, you know, the copper in it, the copper is worth much more than the penny, the 1 cent.
Right.
Because there's so much, you know, dollars in circulation that we've devalued that to where that copper, I mean, more people were holding on to their copper. The reason why they went from copper to this tin alloy crap mm-hmm. is because more people were holding on to that penny.
Yeah. Copper's $3.91 an ounce right now.
There you go. And so what is, how much is in a, how much of an ounce? You can actually go, they'll tell you what the weight of a penny is. And so a penny is a fraction of that. So mm-hmm. we're really looking at probably a 50-cent piece. A penny is about a 50-cent piece.
I'll have that figured out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's okay. We're about 2 minutes, 3 minutes left. So let's see if we can try to, you know, get more of this knocked out because we're still in the middle of this.
Closer. All right. So it is instead of the auction. Okay. Ah, here we go. With respect to our public current security, that's right where I left, right? With respect to our public security and paper money, the apprehensions of gentlemen are groundless. I believe this Constitution cannot affect them at all. In the 10th section of the first article, it is provided, among other restrictions, quote, that no state shall emit bills of credit, make anything but gold or and silver coin a tender in payments of debts, or pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts, end quote. Now, sir, this has no retrospective view. It looks to futurity. It is conceded by many people that the moment this new constitution is adopted, our present paper money will sink to nothing. For my part, I believe that instead of sinking, it will appreciate. If we adopt, it will rise in value so that 20 shillings of it will be equal to two Spanish mil dollars and a half. Paper money is as good as gold and silver where there are proper funds to redeem it and no danger of its being increased. Is this what we just talked about?
Yep, precisely. Keep going. Yep.
Okay, before the late war, our paper money fluctuated in value. 36 years ago, when I came into this country, our paper money was at 7 shillings to the dollar. A few years before the late war, the merchants of Great Britain remonstrated to the ministry of that country that they lost much of their debts by paper money losing its value. This caused an order to be made through all the states not to pass any money bills whatever. The effect of this was that our paper money appreciated. At the commencement of the war, our paper money in circulation was equal to gold or silver. But it is said that on adoption, all debts contracted heretofore must be paid in gold or silver coin.
Okay, let's stop right there. We'll pick up the last couple of sentences that we still have to cover in our next episode tomorrow, folks.
All right.
You know, clearly, we got 30 seconds left. Clearly, they're talking about what we're experiencing.
That's right. Right.
And so there, folks, if we actually got our arms back around this, America would be a very prosperous nation again. The reason the world is being tossed to and fro is because money has become arbitrary and it has become controlled by the globalists, not by our own country for our own interests. This is another form that they've been actually, this is all the different types of warfare they've been committing. Anyway, Paul, thank you for coming. And folks, this is it. So as you can tell, we'll be back tomorrow, and I'm hoping that you're finding the value that we're bringing regarding the ratification debates, bringing this stuff to you so that you can understand how important it is that we all understand the Constitution so that we can stand up for it and demand compliance. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.